The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression recently held an online event entitled People's Hearing on Police Crimes and Torture. We're going to hear a portion of that today. This is the third hearing of this kind that CARPER has organized. Quoting from the Facebook post announcing the event, "These hearings allow us an opportunity to hear from the survivors and families that are at the heart of our movement and the driving force behind the Campaign for Community Control of the Police, or CPAC, and the Campaign to Free Incarcerated Survivors of Police Torture, or CFIST." End quote. We're going to hear a portion of that people's hearing now. Speakers in this segment include Burma Escamilla, one of the family members, Troy Vallis, a Chicago-area activist, writer, and actress who's an experienced community organizer and member of Black Lives Matter Chicago and the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. And the first voice you hear will be Frank Chapman. He's a leader of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression and a field organizer and co-chair of CARPER.
First of all, I want to welcome everybody here. This is really a momentous occasion. We've done three of these hearings in the past, but this is the first time we've ever did one in cyberspace. So this is a new experience for us in that sense, but not a new experience for us in terms of having these people's hearings. But before I get into the people's hearings per se, let me just mention a couple of historical things. One is that the Alliance was founded in 1973, as Hank just pointed out. We came in the wake of the tremendous victory in the Angela Davis case. And also we came in the wake of two tragedies, the murder of Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party here in Chicago, and also Mark Clark. And I just recently heard a speech by Angela that the Black Agenda Reports published. And in that speech, she mentioned, freeing all political prisoners and whatnot. And then she also mentioned community control of the police. So that was 47 years ago. That's how long we have been engaged in this process. But the campaign for CPAC did not begin 47 years ago. The campaign for CPAC began in a setting kind of like this. Bertha was there. It began in Inglewood in 2012. And it began in the wake of the murder of Rakia Bard here in Chicago and Trayvon Martin in Florida. And we had that hearing because we wanted to give to our movement coming out the gate a human face. We wanted people to know who the people are who are suffering from police criminality and police crimes. And so the hearing was done in that spirit. And it was done with the same kind of panelists that we got here today. In fact, a number of people who are here today were here then. People who had their loved ones murdered and people who had their loved ones tortured and falsely imprisoned. That is the fuel of our movement. That's why we have a movement, is to get justice for these families. And so that's why we're here today. We're here to hear from the families. We're here to hear about their struggles for justice, because the beautiful thing about these particular families is that they're not victims anymore. They're not victims of police crimes and police torture. They are freedom fighters. They have joined our movement, and they are the fuel of our movement. So it's very important for us to welcome them. And it's just a couple of things I want to say about the police before we get started, because you need to hear from the families. The police are the cutting edge of mass incarceration. Before you see a jail cell, before you see a prison cell, you see the police. That's why these torture cases are so important to us. You see a police. So we need to understand what we're fighting for here. We're not only fighting for the exoneration and the liberation of the torture survivors, we're fighting for an end to mass incarceration. The police act as judge, jury, and executioner on the streets. Before you see the graveyard, you see the police. So we are dealing with a very serious problem here, and we're dealing with it correctly. The police as the cutting edge of mass incarceration, and the police as our judge, jury, and executioners. So having said that, and since I'm going to speak again, I'm not going to try to say everything now. Having said that, I'd like to hear from the panelists.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Troy Vallis, and I'm an organizer with the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Beginning in the 1980s, Police Commander John Burge led a ring of police officers called the Midnight Crew. These detectives would arrest young Black and brown men and boys, often younger than the age of 18, and hold them at CPD Black sites without access to a lawyer. There, they would beat them, electrocute them, and hold them without access to food or a bathroom for days, often causing them to soil themselves. They would use extreme forms of torture on these young men until they broke them, and at that point, they would make them sign a confession to a crime which they did not commit. On the strength of those forced confessions, and often without other material evidence, CPD was able to secure a countless amount of convictions. In 2015, activists that included family members and survivors won reparations for Burge torture survivors. An ordinance was passed in City Council that mandated the teaching of this legacy of police torture in Chicago public schools. It created the Chicago Torture Justice Center, where panelist Mark Clements currently works. It gave free access to all of Chicago's community colleges to survivors of police torture. On top of that, the city of Chicago publicly apologized for this disgraceful history. Often, when the story of police torture in Chicago is told, it ends there. But the reality is that despite these achievements, there are still hundreds of people who were tortured by Burge, his underlings, or detectives like him that are in prison and fighting for justice to this day. The truth is that the city paid lip service to this legacy and then did nothing to meaningfully help those who were tortured and wrongfully convicted get out of prison as fast as possible and back into their communities. The Campaign to Free Incarcerated Survivors of Police Torture, or CFIST, demands pardons for all those who have been found to have a credible case of torture by the Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission. Asking the governor to pardon those found credible by a governor-appointed commission is the absolute bare minimum that we could ask for. So with that, I would like to introduce our first speaker. Bertha Escamilla is the mother of Nick Escamilla, who was tortured and forced to confess to first-degree murder. Detectives John Halloran, Kenneth Boudreaux, and James O'Brien, all part of the notorious Midnight Crew, committed this crime against him. He was 17 years old. He was convicted and sentenced to 29 years in prison. He was released in 2008 on mandatory supervised release. Bertha is in the forefront of the mothers and fathers of torture survivors and is unrelenting in her struggle to free them all and to see the torturers and killers of innocent Black and Latinx men and women brought to justice. She recognizes the power and stature of these mothers and fathers and stays in close touch with them and is a decisively important part of the struggle to free incarcerated survivors of police torture. So Bertha, we would love to hear from you now.
As you know, my name is Bertha Escamilla, my son, Nick Escamilla. He was sleeping. He worked the graveyard shift when the detectives forced their way in without a search warrant, without an arrest warrant. Nick was kidnapped from his home, took him to the police station, beat him, tortured him, and Nick's wife was pregnant at that time. Nick was threatened that if he did not cooperate, his wife would go to prison and their two-year-old daughter would be taken to DCFS. Nick was forced to make a statement. Nick kept asking for a lawyer. The officers denied his calls. Involved were the corrupt detectives, have long history of forcing statements, tortures, made careers out of this. The names are again Detective Kenneth Boudreau, John Helleran, James O'Brien. They have patterns of doing this. I have 115 cases of these victims who dealt with them. They didn't care how they got a confession. They didn't care what they had to do. As long as they had a confession or a witness that did not have credible, they were not credible. They didn't care. So my son was caught into this. He was found guilty. And since then, I have devoted my life to get justice for my son and all torture victims. And I just would like to say, if you ever get into this situation, please make sure that you request to have these police officers investigated right away. Make sure that you investigate the lawyer that you're about to hire. Make sure that you find out as much as you can about these prosecutors, these judges. You know, you want to know about their background and you need to work on the case. Don't take it for granted that a lawyer, I don't care who he is. You know, not that I have anything against them, but, you know, you have to do your job. You know, we're talking about your loved one, you know. And we are not educated to know about any of this, and we cannot allow to have our lawyers do all of this. So you need to make sure that, you know, you ask for reports on these witnesses.
One minute.
You want to make sure that they're credible. Is that it?
You've got another minute.
Okay, so please make sure. I am in the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. We are fighting for community control against the police to make sure that we have safe streets. I am involved with the CFIS and the MAMAs, a supported group who takes our stories to get attention and support us. This group is only for the MAMAs, unfortunately. Should you consider getting involved, we need to fight for our loved ones. We all have support demanding for torture survivors to come home. We all need to support one another, and please get involved. I don't care what organization it is, get involved. We need everybody's help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard Frank Chapman with the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression, Troy Vallis, a Chicago activist and organizer with CARPER and Black Lives Matter Chicago, and Burma Escamilla, one of the family members who spoke out at this event. They were taking part in the People's Hearing on Police Crimes and Torture, which took place recently and was live-streamed via Zoom and Facebook. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org and HealthSystemsFacts.org. Ngaio Bilum is a comedian, writer, and activist based in California. We talked the other day via Zoom. I was interviewing him for a different show, actually, but, well, here's a bit from that.
Down there in California, one of your state senators is reintroducing legislation that would allow a few of the cities to start doing real harm reduction, overdose prevention, safe consumption sites to be set up. You and I have been to alcohol safe consumption site, which we call bars. We've been to the marijuana safe consumption sites back when they allowed people to have indoor consumption of these. What do you think the harm reduction and what do you think of this development?
I'm a fan of harm reduction in all forms. I generally get the small hamburger when I go to McDonald's. I drink a Diet Cola, which is definitely a form of harm reduction. So I think anything, you know, no one's going to eradicate any particular vice, right? Prostitution's been around forever. Drugs have been around forever. right? Since the first person ate some sort of weird mushroom or decided to set a plant on fire and really liked the effects. So that's not going away. You can't stop people from doing it. If you could stop people from doing it, it would have stopped, right? We threw enough people in jail in the 80s and 90s where you think you would have stopped it. And no, it just made drugs more expensive and people more sneaky, right? So anytime you can help people be safe in their vices, and also people who maybe have overindulged can find help and support with getting their addictions under control, that's always better. It's always better. Education is always better than prohibition, right? Harm reduction is always better than prohibition. We're trying to meet people where they are. And you can't punish your way, you can't arrest your way out of a drug crisis. So I think it's great. Like, you know, if you here's a plug. I got an album called Weedier and Sexier. It's on all the streaming platforms. And I have a whole bit about we need to legalize all these drugs. So we could talk about it.
That's what I appreciate. I mean, you obviously you're a weed comic. You're associated with weed, but you're a drug policy reformer. You're a social justice activist. And you're all, you are all that. Even the, you may Quit laugh. You may laugh, sir.
Think I'm a stoner comic, Doug. Shh. you can't be telling people these things. They'll start to think I'm dangerous. I just want them to know, think that I just travel around and smoke weed and tell jokes. Right?
Subversive.
It's my cover. That's how I get away with things.
Well, let's talk about weed for a minute, because the MORE Act was passed by the House of Representatives, a marijuana opportunity reinvestment equity act was passed by the House a couple of days ago. You don't sound impressed.
I'm not impressed. Look, Mitch McConnell's not going to bring it to the floor. Right. I mean, listen, baby steps are still steps. So this is probably, I think this is the first time the MORE Act has ever actually gotten an actual full floor vote. And I'm glad that it passed. It has some troublesome things in it. Of course, according to federal law, if you have a felony, you can't run a cannabis club, which, you know, you're just cutting a lot of people who are already in the industry out of the industry. So you're turning outlaws into even deeper outlaws, right? Because cats who have gotten into cannabis, they're not known for following rules and regulations. I know it's a shock. You're making a shocked face. I know you're shocked. So you can't really make it so that outlaws have to continue to be outlaws. You got to help people. I feel like out of all of the legalization programs that I've seen, and I haven't been to Michigan or Illinois yet, but I feel like Oregon for most of its problems has done it mostly the right way. They made the barrier to entry ridiculously low. And so everybody can get into it. And sure, a lot of people got into it and lost their shirts and they're no longer in it, but they had a chance to get into it, as opposed to like California, where you need like $5 million. You need $2 million just to get involved, right? And so that doesn't make any sense. And also the taxes are crazy high. So why would I go to a club and spend $60 plus tax, which is like 20% after you get state and local taxes involved, when I could just go to the secret sessions, which are still taking place, and buy eighth of weed, which is just the same quality for $40, for $35, right? So the thing about Oregon is, like, they're damn near giving weed away. You could buy a joint for $1. You could buy an eighth of really good weed for $30, for $40. And that's where the prices should be. I mean, you know, I half of me is like, that's not fair to the farmer. Right. Because now the farmers got to grow almost twice as much cannabis on the same amount of land to receive the same amount of profit that they were getting 10 or 15 years ago when it was illegal. But I also know that there's really no black market for cannabis in Oregon. Right. You don't really have to call your homie and go, hey, man, where can I get some weed? Because it's bountiful and inexpensive. I mean, maybe if you're in Eastern Oregon, where those guys don't really allow dispensaries, unless you're Russ. Russ has one close to Idaho, I understand. But other than that, you know, you have to make it easier for people to buy weed and easier for people to be legal. Cats who were already used to operating outside of the parameters of the regulations are not going to have a problem maintaining that. Right. That's why we don't call it the black market anymore. We call it the traditional market or the legacy market. That's what they call it in Canada, the legacy businesses.
That was my friend Ngaio Bealum, good friend of the show. He's a comedian, writer, lives in California. You can find him on Instagram and Twitter, where he's Ngaio420, and of course on Facebook, where he's Ngaio Bealum. You should definitely check him out. He's a very funny man. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The National Harm Reduction Coalition has released a new training guide entitled Spirit of Harm Reduction, a Toolkit for Communities of Faith Facing Overdose. They recently held a webinar to introduce that toolkit. Let's hear now from the Reverend Sarah Howell Miller.
To get a sense of why we felt like a toolkit for this particular purpose was important. So first, to help faith leaders understand the issues and lead faith communities in becoming better allies to people who use drugs and people who do sex work. There are often very good intentions among faith communities, but a deeper understanding and listening more to people with direct lived experience is something that I think a lot of communities of faith can grow in. And I say that as an ordained minister myself. To foster concrete support for local harm reduction work, both on the ground and in terms of policy awareness and change. To resource faith communities in incorporating stigma-reducing language into ritual, education, outreach, and more, and to support harm reductionists with a resource for engaging with faith leaders in the course of their organizing. And we are really leaning into the beautiful messiness that is seeking to reach out both to harm reductionists and people who use drugs and people who do sex work, and to faith communities, recognizing that those audiences often overlap, but often are different in their approach and understanding. But we embrace that and want to dig into that more, and are grateful for y'all being here today to participate in that. So just an overview of what the toolkit does. The Faith and Harm Reduction Toolkit makes the case for why faith communities need harm reduction. It educates on issues related to substance use and racialized drug policy. The educational piece is not comprehensive, but is designed to be introductory to a lot of these issues. It provides diverse ritual resources. It stories the harm reduction movement with sermons, personal narratives, poetry, and more, and gives faith communities concrete action steps to supporting harm reduction practices and policies. And today, as our speakers address you, there will be folks who are both presenting some of their ritual resources, as well as just talking about why such resources are important in this movement. And then we'll get to hear from some of the folks whose stories are involved in what we call the Voices of Harm Reduction section of the toolkit. Just a note about this resource, that it is a living document. We're hoping to continue to have it evolve and grow as this movement grows. One thing, the initial version of this toolkit was focused largely on overdose, and we're hoping to expand some of the resources there. But a lot of the work that you'll see is sort of just beginning, really, to dig it in. So we hope that you'll join us on this journey of learning and growing. The toolkit starts by making the case for why we're here and setting the table. And we have Erica, who spoke earlier, lays out sort of the moral problem and why the question of overdose and of stigma against people who use drugs and people who do sex work is something that communities of faith need to be concerned with and need to address. We also do some just basic laying out of what is harm reduction. And we say that harm reduction is both a set of practical strategies and ideas aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use, and a movement for social justice built on a belief in and a respect for the rights of people who use drugs. And we talk more about how that ties in specifically with communities of faith. We also have an invitation to action and outlines of specific harm reduction services and what those can look like, which there's a wide variety of the material kinds of support that harm reduction can offer. Do so a little bit of education on the substance use spectrum, which embraces both abstinence as not being opposed to harm reduction, but as being a part of the spectrum, and it not being either or, that everyone has their own journey when it comes to substance use, and that it's important for folks who want to be allies to understand and support people on that. Also just address some resources around understanding opioid and opioid overdose, as well as use and overdose on other kinds of drugs as well. We have some resources and guidelines for establishing a plan for responding to overdose in your place of worship, and training on how to respond to an overdose. We
advocate for all communities of faith and places of worship to have naloxone, the opioid overdose reversal drug, on hand, and to have people trained in understanding how to recognize and respond to opioid overdose on your property or in events that you may be holding, which we recognize is a little different these days during COVID. We also try to outline medications for opioid use disorder and give a brief intro to the relationship between racism and drug policy. Obviously, that is a huge topic, so we just barely scratched the surface there, but it's important. As Jose read our North Star statement for the National Harm Reduction Coalition, we think it's always important to center that in conversations around substance use and overdose. We really believe that one of the big things that communities of faith can do to support harm reduction efforts is to work to change the way that stigma is upheld and perpetuated. We recognize that communities of faith have often been guilty of perpetuating stigma even without intending to, and offer some suggestions for ways that communities of faith can take the lead in shifting some of the language and behavior and assumptions that contribute to stigma, which we know that stigma can and is deadly to people who use drugs and people who do sex work. So this is, when we talk about language, it's not about being politically correct. It is about saving lives. We also have a host of spiritual and ritual resources, from having questions for a faith community to consider how to be better allies to people who use drugs, how to offer sanctuary, many different prayers and blessings that Reverend M. Barclay and Blythe Barnow will talk with us a little bit more about in a bit. Different rituals that can be part of, say, an overdose awareness day or a ceremony for remembering folks who are lost, and both remembering folks lost to overdose and upholding the resilience of the communities that prevent overdose on a daily basis. And then finally, the bulk of our section is this Voices of Harm Reduction section, where we uplift personal stories of people who, both faith leaders, people who use drugs, people who do sex work, and other harm reductionists, to give more of a personal face, put a face to this whole conversation. So we have a series of sermons. We have interviews with some of the folks who are going to be speaking with you in a minute. We have poetry and letters. And here's another couple of samples of titles of interviews and articles that we have in the toolkit that represent some of these voices. And you'll be hearing from, well, I myself and all of these people you'll be hearing from today. We also at the end have ways to respond in action, and concrete ways for communities of faith to extend hospitality, to build community, to participate in advocacy, and to offer compassionate care to people who use drugs.
That was the Reverend Sarah Howell Miller. She's a bioethicist, musician, and associate pastor at Green Street United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She was speaking on a National Harm Reduction Coalition webinar entitled Spirit of Harm Reduction, a Toolkit for Communities of Faith Facing Overdose. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.